Well, good afternoon, everyone. Carla Peluso, state representative, and we are, well, I will call to order the task force on the testing of sexual assault and forensic evidence kits. So do I gavel at this? Is, even though it's okay.
Just one.
There we go. One gavel. So it's an informational meeting. Thanks for being here, folks. Since we don't have a packed house, let's feel free to have some open and conversation that let's just take advantage of that time. But to start with, I would like to ask, we'll pass on Captain Gardner right now, and hopefully he will be joining us later. But Kevin Campbell, could you come up, please?
Great. Thank you, Chair Peluso and members of the task force. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and it is my pleasure to be here to provide a little bit of an update on some of the things we're doing from an association perspective in order to try to assist the task force with the work that you're doing. I want to begin briefly by talking a little bit about education of our associations related to this important issue. We recently had our fall leadership conference, which took place in September. We gather chiefs and sheriffs from around the state for professional development training, but we also have the opportunity to update the leadership on issues of importance, and this is one of them that we spent time educating our leaders regarding, in particular, the passage of Senate Bill 960, some of the changes that are occurring there, which do impact, of course, what kits should be sent for testing and those that should not. So I wanted to make sure that you knew that we continue to help them get up to speed to the degree that continues to be necessary as the law has changed and adjusted in order to ensure that those kits that need to be going for testing are going the way they should. That's still a little bit of a work in progress. You know, we don't have 100% participation there, but we also send out information regularly to make sure that agencies are updating their policies, because this is a policy change, and that there are a number of entities that help agencies come up to speed with new laws and policies, and that's occurring too through groups like Lexipol and others that have the responsibility for making sure that the agencies that they help have that resource, have updated policies, and understand what the changes mean in practical terms. So that's the first thing. We did that during the fall leadership conference. The other thing, though, that I want to talk about today is our effort to provide you with an updated look at where we really are with regard to the backlog, because we haven't done a survey for a while, and we are in a very rigorous process right now to get you updated numbers, and we're close. I was so hoping to be able to provide it all to you today, but I'm hounding some agencies, and there were some numbers that came in that didn't look right, so we're checking them to make sure they're accurate, and sometimes folks get a little bit confused about what the actual numbers mean. So we'll be able to provide for this task force an updated list of how many still of the pre-January 1, 2017 kits. Those are the ones that, you know, fall under the Senate Bill 1571, passage of 1571, that represent the actual backlog. How many of those still reside in agencies today that have not been sent to OSP for testing? And then how well are we doing at following the new protocols post-1571 that require agencies to send immediately for testing those kits? The one piece, as I've mentioned already, that is resulting in agencies having to make adjustment is they are now reevaluating kits that were previously considered anonymous that with the new definition will be sent. And it's clear in the survey results I'm getting already, they're identifying those, and they're working on a plan to send those in. It is instructive, and this won't surprise you, that in an environment where you're dealing with 36 county sheriff's offices and roughly 125 municipal police departments, you're going to have a few departments that didn't realize they were supposed to be sending certain kits in. So we've got a few that we're working with. The good news is a number of them already have arrangements with the Oregon State Police. We don't want to dump kits in a way that makes it impossible for OSP to work. So a lot of them are working on a plan where they've got a certain number of kits they'll be sending every month until their backlog is erased. I have not been able to give you kind of the total number left in the backlog, those pre-January 1 numbers. But I think that the prediction may have been in a couple thousand. What I'm seeing so far indicates there's far less than that. But I'll know when I hound everybody and get the final numbers in. I think that's good news for everybody here. And like I said, it appears that agencies are largely compliant with sending the kits in now post the passage of Senate Bill 1571. So I'm hopeful to get those to you right away. The other two questions I asked all agencies is, are you in compliance with the requirements of Senate Bill 1571 related to having updated policies based on the provisions of that bill? And I will tell you it's a good 95% compliance. There's a few agencies that were honest enough to say no. And I think that's good because those are agencies we've now identified, and it's just a remediation thing. So we're going to be able to go out to those agencies, ensure that they have their policies in place, and we'll be doing that. If we identify any more in these final groupings of agencies that are responding, that's our checklist of responsibility we have as associations to ensure that they're doing what they're supposed to do. And then just the final question or the final item that I asked on the survey is related to the response from police departments to pick up kits in instances where a hospital has conducted a test and has it there to be picked up by law enforcement. Now, a lot of times, as you know, law enforcement is actually involved on the front end and there's a connection already, but there's often times where somebody comes in, the hospital conducts a test, the kit is there for pickup, and as you know, we've created timelines so that we can make sure that those test kits are picked up within a reasonable amount of time. And the question I was asked is, what happens if we reduce the time for law enforcement agencies to pick up to 24 hours? The answer is, in large part, it's not an issue, and it is clearly a priority of agencies to get over there right away. However, I identified a number of agencies, and I want to say, between 12 to 15, as you can guess, smaller agencies in more rural locations where the hospital is a fair distance and where their staffing levels are inconsistent, where they're concerned about a 24-hour period. It's clear they all want to get there, and my guess is most of them do. The expectation is they pick them up immediately. And so I guess the answer would be it would create a potential problem for some small agencies to do that response, small and rural. I'll get you specific answers on that, though, and because as I continue to complete it, I'll have a better idea, but already we've identified a number that have expressed some concern based on those two factors. And so with that, Chair Peluso and members of the task force, I'm glad to answer any questions you might have for me regarding any of these things. And then my goal is by end of the year to get you the detail. That way you'll be able to, I don't know when you're meeting next, but at least you'll have it. You'll be able to evaluate and have the numbers and see where we're at. So
go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who the appropriate person to ask is, but with all this backlog and all these tests coming up, have any of these turned into leads? Have contributed to investigations that were bolstered because of these particular kits and maybe convictions? I don't know.
Yeah, Chair Peluso and Senator Thatcher, that's a great question. I asked it just recently because I was curious. In fact, I don't know if D.A. Underhill may have an answer in terms of Multnomah County. I know in other states there are certainly cases that came out of them, and I don't know if we've been able to compile the numbers yet. But
I'll do my best off the top of my head to give at least a pretty close to accurate answer, I think. I'll try as best I can. So the short answer is yes. There have been cases that have resulted in Lane County and Multnomah County that have resulted in grand jury indictments and moving forward with prosecutions. I'll back up a little bit and say, just as a kind of a baseline of remembering, there was my office together with Marion County and Lane County were the most kind of first and maybe the most thorough of clearing out addressing the backlog issue. So just by way of numbers, in those three counties, there were 2,610 safe kits that, and maybe a little statistics as I weave through answering your question, Senator. So backing up, those three counties, grand total of 2,610 safe kits between the three counties have been forwarded at this point to Sorensen Lab, which is physically located in Utah, for purposes of testing. That is essentially all of the backlog kits in those three counties. To date, well, I shouldn't say to date, on November 7th, so this is about 9 days old, this data that I'm providing, 2,088 of those 2,600 have been tested, analyzed by Sorensen. The number of kits that, as a result of the analysis, that had no DNA or insufficient DNA for CODIS entry is 1,319. The number of kits, so of the remaining, those move on to Oregon State Police. They, in a way, the data is returned to Oregon. The physical kit is returned to the jurisdiction whence they came. The data goes to the Oregon State Police for review. There are pending in that status are 413. The number of kits that have profiles that have been entered into CODIS by OSP is 283. The number of kits evaluated by OSP but not entered due to eligibility issues are 73. And the number of CODIS hits, quote unquote, has been 140. Of those 140, here's where I don't have the data right in front of me, but I can tell you just by way of best memory that I've got. My memory is Lane County has had a CODIS hit that investigatively was sufficient enough to proceed with indictment and prosecution effort. That is also true in my jurisdiction. What I'm just a little bit blanking on is that one, two, or three for us? It's certainly one. I think it's either two or three for us where prosecutions have moved forward as a result of this effort. So hopefully that answers. To the extent you want to drill down, Senator, with more detail, I can put you in touch with the leads with respect to who
good.
Literally
I has. I think it's good information. It's good to know that this is actually bearing fruit.
It's so happening. Nice. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. They are working their way through these systems, and we are set up. The resources within my office are: I have a full-time prosecutor assigned to this project, a full-time forensic evidence former. Oregon State Police Crime Lab forensic evidence scientist that works for me at this juncture, and then a full-time victim advocate. And they are, together with our partners in law enforcement, working through all of these cases as they are now beginning to come back and looking at the investigative-based implications of what is found by the laboratory analysis.
That's good. I mean, it's easy to remember, okay, we got all these kits and then we have to process them. But the whole point of processing is to, get some justice.
Yes, so, definitely.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Any other questions? Oh, comments. Thank you.
One. And I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask. Thank you, Chair Peluso.
Probably not. Just looking at me, you might guess. Probably not me, but.
One of the things that we heard in our last meeting that has kind of been running around in the back of my head and is sort of disturbing me, quite frankly, is that there's, in a lot of these hospitals and a lot of these jurisdictions, not a dedicated place to keep the safe kit once it's been collected. And you know and I know that contaminated biological evidence isn't any good at all. And so I guess what's being done to make sure that these safe kits are being kept in a way that we're making sure they're not being contaminated? And is there any movement in that area? And maybe you're not the right person to ask.
Yeah. Chair Peluso, yes. I don't have a complete answer to that. I do know that the hospital does work off of the same chain of custody requirements that law enforcement does. In other words, they do have procedures for ensuring that the way the kid is treated is keeps contamination from occurring. The challenge hospitals have, because I represent them also, is what you've said, which is there are storage limitations. And so they can't have any kind of test like this that just accumulates. And that's why there's a sensitivity to making sure that within a fairly quick period of time, there is both a notice of law enforcement and a response to pick up. And I do think it's important if there's any sense there are particular jurisdictions where there's an issue developing that we know, because I want to make sure that we're on top of ensuring that those are being picked up. But it was clear that hospitals were saying, look, we can't have these sitting around for the reasons you mentioned. You know, they're not equipped to store stuff for long periods of time. But my understanding is most hospitals do have an appropriate location, just not space. And they obviously don't want them sitting there any longer than at all possible.
I'm a lawyer, and one of the things that occurred to me, because that's what I do, is it would be a nightmare for the hospitals, legal liability as well. I'd be losing sleep if I was a hospital attorney, quite frankly.
Exactly, and there is, I believe that the nice thing about what we structured timelines is they're not outrageously tight, but there's a pretty strong expectation that the notification and the pickup are quick. And I think our agencies are eager to do that. So I'm sensing in even the survey results that's clear. They seem to be squared away on that. But again, if there's a jurisdiction that we need to address for whatever reason, we'd love to know, because we're glad to be a partner in that. I think that's a part we can play. It's a good question. Thank you.
Other questions?
Chair Peluso, yes. Question, if I might, Mr. Campbell. Well, thank you for all your continued hard work, yours in the past, today, and ongoing, no doubt. Thank you. Continued hard work. So this question and kind of conversation a little bit, because I've got a few pieces of information surrounding the question, deals with the 2,000 or so, possibly, hopefully less, as you commented on, existing backlog around the state. So while I touched on with some statistics the three counties that I addressed, we've got 33 other counties, and we're working on addressing those backlogs. So just by way of kind of example, that 2610 for our three counties, we estimated before we actually began to send them to Sorensen as closer to 3,000. So it a little bit doesn't surprise me, and I remain optimistic that it will be less than 2,000. I'm interested in, as are you, no doubt, making sure that we're working together with the Oregon State Police Crime Lab to recognize our resource implications to what could amount to, I'll use the round number 2,000 just for, point, and trying to work through that while being respectful of those resource implications, because they've got these day forward cases as well. What we were able to obtain, the three counties, Multnomah, Lane, Marion, we obtained a grant through the district DA New York, right, grant opportunity that paid for the testing, the physical testing of these kits through Sorensen. There may be another opportunity there in that area. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, so I'm choosing my words carefully, but there may be another opportunity. But there is some time sensitivity to it also, possibly. So this deals with my very much interest in understanding what counties have what. You know, right. What is that number? Who has 200 versus 2, 300 versus 23, as we begin to, all right, is there some more other available resources to help the Oregon State Police by not having them necessarily conduct the testing, but consider Sorensen, for example, as an opportunity. So trying to weave this into a question, because it sounds more like a statement, doesn't it?
Good.
When do you think you'll be able to, even if it's not a complete analysis, at least for my purposes with what I've just said, because of the time sensitivity, I'm frankly interested in whatever you have as soon as you're willing to share it with me.
Yeah, so Chair Peluso and Dia Underhill, I mentioned that I believe we could get a complete inventory done by the end of the year, but I may be able to speed that up. I'm really at the point now where I've bugged them, now I'm making individual calls. My goal is to get that complete fairly quickly. I would say that we have very few larger agencies that aren't already in, which is good. That means that the number that we're likely to see that from now on out are not likely to be big numbers. So I would say I would work to your timeline in order to make sure you have the information and time to approach another grant opportunity, because I think that would be fantastic. And, you know, as it is right now, I think agencies are working closely with OSP once they realize they've got backlog kits to get in to work with OSP to in partnership to figure out how to do that well. But I would love to make sure you have that information and participate in any grant opportunity. I think that would be working smart, and I know that OSP would appreciate anything we can do to reduce the
impact. I think I'm seeing a nod back there. Maybe we have an OSP representative. Well, thank you, Mr. Campbell, and we'll be in touch with that kind of
so we'll get that done quickly so you can have that information, and
be great.
Thank you, appreciate the time today.
Any other
thanks
questions
for your work?
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, so next up, Belinda, you want to talk to us about training and access to care, the access to care survey?
Yeah, I'd love to. Do I have to go down there?
Wherever you're okay.
No, you're fine there.
I was like, oh, it's not really all that crowded in here. So my name is Bibi Beltran. I'm the Executive Director of Sexual Assault Support Services, or SASS, in Linn County. And I was actually asked by Michelle Roland Schwartz, who is Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, to provide updates, as I believe she's boarding a plane right now to Denver for some training that the SATF is doing. And so the updates I was asked to give was one on the Senate Bill 795. So that was passed, and it essentially what codified practice that was already happening, but just mandated that when a sexual assault survivor presents at a medical facility for some type of aftercare in the aftermath of a traumatic sexual assault, that an advocate is called and responds in person, and also provides not just information about advocacy services, but lets them know that they can decline services at any time. So that's pretty much what we've been doing all along. This just makes it formal. And in recognition of the fact that there are 36 counties and there are 36 ways of responding, probably more, we wanted to do a webinar so that folks can kind of have a sense of what's new and what isn't new. So that will happen on Monday, December 11th at 2 p.m., and I will be one of the instructors, as will Kim Larson, who's the director of the Victims Assistance Program in Marion County. See Nicole Broder, who is the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program Coordinator with the SATF, and then also Lisa Norton, who is Executive Director of My Sister's Place, which is on the coast, and also Michelle Roland Schwartz. So we're hoping that it will actually be fairly smooth. We've done a lot of outreach to other agencies to see what their concerns are, and hopefully we'll address those. And then the other item that Michelle asked me to update y'all on is the Access to Care Survey. So this is a survey that is put together by the Victims Response Subcommittee of the Sexual Assault Task Force. And really, it's to better inform policy going forward and to get a really good sense of what's going on in other communities. So it's not done yet. It's still being tweaked by the Victim Response Subcommittee. But sample questions include things like, are there SANEs in your county? How many medical facilities provide, safe kit exams? And if they do, how long is the wait? Things like that. So we can really understand what's going on and what the needs are, so we can create good policy, not just based on exceptions, but rather something that works for the entire state. So those are the updates.
Cool. Again, questions, comments?
Well, I guess I'm wondering, what are the concerns that are kind of bubbling to the surface as something that may be more problematic, more difficult to overcome, as far as meeting the requirement now through 795?
I'm not sure, because from my perspective, this is something that agencies like SASS have been doing. So I think that some of the concerns that we've had are, I don't think that this bill is actually going to address at all. This is more about having advocates respond in person. This doesn't have anything to do with whether or not we medical facilities actually have SANEs, which actually I think is a bigger problem, but it's a different issue than this. So what this is really is just ensuring that survivors, when they present, have access to somebody with expertise and information, impartial information, that they can utilize either right then and there, once or ongoing, and also, of course, that they can decline at any time. So it's, I don't know. I think the issues, like I said, the concerns that have kind of been brought to our attention, this is not going to address. But it will be about capacity. That's one of the biggest things, my guess would be.
Great.
Anything else?
We like quick updates. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So up next, Jacqueline Swanson.
There.
Hey, thanks for being here with us today.
Of course. So good afternoon, Chair Peluso and members of the task force. Thank you for inviting me to speak here today. My name is Jacqueline Swanson. Most of you know me through my work with Brenda Tracy, but for those of you who don't, I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon. I have a lot of experience representing survivors of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and victims of crime. Before I became a lawyer, I was a sexual assault victim advocate for a number of years. It's what propelled me to go to law school in the first place. I went to Lewis and Clark, which the reason I chose it is because it's the only law school with a crime victims rights program in the country. And I got to work under Doug Ballouf and other giants, and Meg Garvin and the others. So I was invited here today to talk about two topics that were presented to the task force for discussion under Melissa's Law, sections 73C and 73E. Which direct the task force to examine and identify improvements for victims' access to evidence other than sexual assault forensic evidence kits, and examine and identify additional rights of victims concerning sexual assault forensic evidence kits. So to that end, I have gone through and identified several issues which I believe are ripe for discussion. Where possible, I have attempted to raise these issues in a manner that lends insight into possible solutions. That said, this is a brief presentation on a complicated subject, and I do not claim to have all of the answers. My goal is rather to flag these issues in order to facilitate a dialogue, which will be ongoing among you all, individuals chosen to serve on this task force, for your expertise and understanding of the systems and resources at your disposal, and insight into particular challenges presented by specific methods of resolution. So, and kind of on that note, I'd also observe that I haven't been a participant in the task force at meetings up to this point, so I've tried not to retread territory that I know you've already visited, like barriers to victims being able to access SANE nurses in rural counties, which was something that we actually had an informational hearing about not too long ago. I think it was Senate Bill 884. But please forgive me if I identify an issue that you've already discussed or taken under advisement. So with that in mind, I would turn to the topic of, well, actually, I should say one more thing. A couple of bills obviously were passed last session which relate to this issue, like SB 795. And although I do my best to keep apprised of all legislation that is passed that's relevant to this issue, this is not my full-time job. I'm not perfect. I'm a lawyer. So I do my best to never say never and sprinkle caveats liberally throughout all my introductions. So with that in mind, to turn to the topic at hand, which beginning with kind of going through and addressing what some of the relevant provisions of Melissa's Law are in the context of this discussion. So, as we all know, Melissa's Law pertains to the preservation, collection, reporting, and testing of non-anonymous safe kits. Among other things, it mandates testing of non-anonymous safe kits, prohibits testing of anonymous safe kits, and requires law enforcement agencies to adopt policies which ensure preservation of all safe kits for at least 60 years, permit sexual assault victims to request and receive information concerning the safe kits, and requires law enforcement agencies to adopt policies requiring like a designated person to respond to a victim inquiry about their safe kit within 30 days. So the requirements and provision of Melissa's Law only apply to safe kit evidence. And Melissa's Law defines safe kit evidence as forensic evidence collected using an evidence collection kit during a sexual assault medical assessment as described in ORS 147.395. And I gave you a handout, and it should have like the actual definitions from that statute in it. But essentially, ORS 147.395 relates to the SAVE fund, the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Medical Fund, Response Fund. And it defines a medical assessment essentially as a medical examination as well as a collection of forensic evidence using an evidence collection kit approved by the Department of State Police, and then the offering and provision of emergency contraception treatment for STDs. So the SAVE Fund obviously was created in order to ensure that a victim wouldn't be required to pay for her own rape kit. And the Oregon administrative rules provide that, you know, an eligible medical services provider who submits a bill to the fund is not allowed to bill the victim subsequently or the victim's insurance carrier for a medical examination, collection of forensic evidence, or, you know, the provision of provision of prophylactics for a sexually transmitted disease or pregnancy. But this kind of gets to the first stopping point, at least for me, which is the SAVE Fund doesn't actually cover everything that victims frequently need. It doesn't cover the costs of, for example, toxicology screenings, like screenings for GHB or Rohypnol, nor does it cover treatment of injuries, DNA testing, HIV testing, laboratory testing of blood for any purpose other than pregnancy, and prescriptions that are filled off-site of the location from the medical exam. And despite the fact that a medical provider isn't allowed to bill for services relating to the medical examination, the forensic exam, or emergency contraception, that doesn't preclude them from submitting a claim against the victim or the victim's insurance companies for anything else that's not covered within that category. So I personally have met a number of victims over the years who were billed for their rape kits as well as other things associated with it. Sometimes in amounts, usually it's, you know, around $800, $900, but I've seen it exceeding a few thousand. And frequently these issues can be addressed by a very strongly worded letter, but not all attorneys are able or willing to help victims out in this pro bono capacity, and very few victims have the means to actually pay for that. Plus, they oftentimes just don't even know. They're usually, to the extent they're told in the beginning, you won't be billed for this, and then they get a bill, and it's shocking. And for that reason, you know, a letter doesn't actually always solve it. Because, I mean, in two instances that I can think of recently, the victims didn't even find out they had been billed until it was sent to collection and their credit was negatively impacted. So, and also sometimes the insurer or the medical provider is actually technically within their rights to bill the victim for these additional costs associated with it, given the limitations on what the SAVE Fund can actually provide for. So I think this is one of those issues, right, that it comes up within this context, and it's something that's ripe for discussion here. I think there are a few potential solutions. One thing that comes to mind immediately to me, and again, I'm not fully aware of the scope of this problem. BB probably has a better idea than me just how often this actually happens, but I've certainly seen it enough to know I think if it's an exception, it's a pretty common one that happens. So even just having a person designated for a victim to contact within an agency or organization, or providing a form that the victim can use to send to their hospital or the insurance company that says, nope, you're not allowed to bill me for these things. You know, maybe you can't bill me for the other. That's a different issue. But I think that would be a helpful resource for a lot of victims, just because, again, they frequently don't know where to turn. So that said, coming back to these other topics. So Melissa's Law only applies to safe kits. And then although that's not really expressly defined in the statutes or the OARs, safe kits generally contain physical and documentary evidence of the forensic medical exams, like demographic information, pertinent and recent health history, medical provider notes, information pertaining to the assaults and the assailants, injury logs, photographs, specimens of the victim's bodily fluids, blood, urine, tissue, fingernail scrapings, hair, and clothing. But the primary reason that I addressed that is because none of the provisions of Melissa's Law, most notably the directives that evidence be retained and the provision allowing victims to request information from law enforcement agencies about the status of their safe kit, apply to other types of physical and documentary evidence collected during the investigation of the offense. And to demonstrate what I mean when I say other evidence, I'll briefly recount Brenda Tracy's story, which I'm sure everyone here is familiar with. In 98, Brenda attended a small gathering with her then best friend at her friend's boyfriend's house. She was given a cup of Tanqueray and orange juice. She took 2 to 3 sips of it and then blacked out. For the next about 6 hours, she would experience a waking nightmare consisting of her being repeatedly raped by four men while she passed in and out of consciousness. You know, they kept raping her as she vomited, high-fiving each other as she sobbed and pleaded with them to stop. At some point during the rape, her vagina became so swollen they could no longer penetrate her, prompting them to use a flashlight and ice in an attempt to continue the acts upon her. She awoke the next morning naked in the middle of the living room floor, alone, condom wrappers stuck to her body and gum in her hair, feeling like, in her words, a piece of garbage. She promptly reported the crime to police, underwent a sexual assault forensic exam. The medical examination itself demonstrated severe trauma to her genitals, noticeable enough for the nurse examiner and the doctor who examined her to recall it independently 16 years later when interviewed by John Canzano. Law enforcement did a thorough investigation. They served a search warrant and logged key evidence from the crime scene, including but not limited to at least 5 used condoms, alcohol bottles, hair and fiber, clothing, the flashlight that was used, and the cup that she drank out of, which likely contained traces of a date rape drug. The suspects were arrested, and during tape-recorded interviews, all 4 of the men confessed, admitted, or implicated one another in the commission of the crime. But Brenda was never informed of the existence of any of this evidence. She was told it was a he said, she said case. And more than a decade after the fact, Brenda would come to learn, through John Canzano's reporting, not only that this evidence had once existed, but also that it had been destroyed 3 years before the expiration of the statute of limitations. If Melissa's law were in effect at the time of Brenda's rape, her rape kit would have been preserved until 2058. And she would be permitted to ask for information and receive updates regarding the status of the testing of her rape kit. The law would not, however, provide for the preservation and testing of all of that other evidence that was collected in her case, such as the flashlight, which could have at least aided in corroborating her version of the events, or the cup, which may have provided concrete evidence of drug-facilitated sexual assault, nor would she have been permitted to request and receive information about any of that evidence. Likewise, Melissa's law wouldn't have provided her with the ability to receive copies of, for example, the documentary evidence contained in a safe kit, like the medical examiner's notes. To provide yet another example of what I mean when I say other evidence at issue here, there's this case of a woman who we'll call Jane Doe in Memphis. She had waited 24 years for her safe kit to be tested. When the kit was finally tested, law enforcement informed her that no DNA evidence was found. However, in their haste, officers had failed to examine the reports made at the time of the incident and the information contained in the rape kit, which had indicated that the attackers wore condoms. And during the initial investigation, the police did recover 2 used condoms at the crime scene, and they booked them into evidence. Those 2 condoms could have provided the DNA evidence not otherwise found in the rape kit, but even though the crime had no statute of limitations, police had destroyed the condoms a full 10 years before ever actually coming back and testing the rape kit itself. And for her part, Jane Doe never even learned about any of this until a reporter managed to get a hold of the police report, which she previously had not been able to. I'm going to come back to that point in a second. So to maintain the chain of custody, as we're all aware, law enforcement officers commonly track property and evidence by filling out evidence and property receipts. And copies of those receipts are kept in the records division, along with the police report and follow-up investigation, as well as accompany the property of the evidence itself. And I don't want to say this incorrectly, so if I recall correctly, I think this was how Portland homicide detectives were able to link the murder and rape of Melissa Bittler to those prior assaults. It was after they were going through older police reports and looking for a similar modus operandi, and they found out there was additional evidence still in the storage room connected to prior assaults, which otherwise matched the MO.
Yes.
Theoretically, at least, it wouldn't be difficult to amend these particular provisions of Melissa's law pertaining to the disclosure of information about what evidence, additional evidence, was collected during the investigation of the offense. I think given storage considerations, instead of requiring that the evidence be retained for 60 years, it makes more sense to instead provide a victim with notice prior to destruction of the evidence, as well as an accounting of what the evidence is. And if applicable, perhaps, before it's destroyed, certainly permit the victim to take possession of it. The idea being that if the evidence is going to be destroyed anyway, the state doesn't really have an interest in retaining it, and there's little harm in allowing the victim to take the evidence into his or her own possession so that they could use it in a civil suit or some other non-criminal adjudicatory proceeding. But currently, many victims, sexual assault victims in particular, have experienced tremendous difficulty even getting copies of the initial incident report in their case, much less other types of case information, such as follow-up investigation reports or evidence logs or witness statements. And this is in and of itself problematic, as there are many legitimate reasons why a victim would want or need a copy of the police report. For example, they could use it to provide proof to their employer that they wanted to take unpaid protected leave under ORS 659A272, or to pursue other rights relating to employment or housing, such as breaking their lease early or changing locks. Police reports also contained key information that allows a survivor to evaluate whether or not there's enough information or evidence available out there to pursue a civil action against the perpetrator. So at this point, I think it bears noting that the civil statute of limitations for adult sexual assault victims is 2 years. 2 years, the same as a car accident. Similarly, if their rape or sexual assault also constituted sexual harassment or sex discrimination under, for example, Oregon employment laws, the victim only actually has 1 year to bring a civil case. So, and contrary to popular belief, because I've heard this a lot, the civil statute of limitations does not toll while there is an active criminal investigation or an active criminal case pending. So absent amendments to these laws, it's all the more important to ensure that victims receive timely access to relevant case information and evidence in order to allow them to evaluate whether or not they even can proceed with a civil action. Furthermore, juries in civil cases are just as likely to fall victim to the CSI effect as juries in criminal cases, meaning, by which I mean, they expect production of forensic and DNA evidence, and if it doesn't exist or they don't see it, they assume that means the victim must be lying or it didn't actually happen. This also kind of underscores the need for some kind of written acknowledgement or notification when the results of the kit testing come back to the victim, as opposed to just verbal. That way, if it was in a form that could be at least arguably admissible in a civil proceeding as a business record or some other exception, that way we don't actually have to subpoena like the state crime police or the state crime lab's forensic investigators, which would be a hassle for pretty much everyone involved. So likewise, medical examiner's notes and the victim's statements contained in the rape kit can also be extremely valuable tools to aid in establishing the victim's credibility before a jury. All of these issues are compounded by the fact that many people tend to mistakenly assume that the statute of limitations for civil causes of action for adult victims is the same as the criminal SOL, or they otherwise misconstrue the provisions of ORS 12117, which only applies to child sex abuse victims. I'd be happy to discuss the numerous and varied reasons why the SOL for adult victims should be extended, but that, I think, is a conversation for another day. Coming back to this issue, Oregon's lack of policies regarding victim access to case information on this point seems to be in direct contrast to what I've seen in the national trend. A number of other states go even further than allowing the victim to get a prompt copy of the police report. They have laws which expressly permit a victim to receive copies of the police report free of charge, without the need to file a public records request, and with the knowledge that they have a right to request and receive it. I provided some statutes from other jurisdictions that have language like this for you to look at. This in turn brings me to the next topic, which is additional rights of victims concerning the sexual assault forensic evidence kit testing process. So, as noted previously, Melissa's law requires law enforcement agencies to adopt policies and procedures relating to the testing and collection of safe kits and contact with victims. But Melissa's law doesn't actually provide victims with the right to obtain a safe kit, or the right to have their safe kit tested, or the right to receive information about the status of their kit. The Oregon Crime Victims Bill of Rights declares that victims of crime are entitled to fair and impartial treatment in our criminal justice system, and victims' rights shall be protected at each stage of the criminal proceeding. The Oregon Constitution likewise provides crime victims with a number of foundational rights, such as the right to be present and informed at any critical stage of the proceeding, the right to obtain information about the conviction, sentence, imprisonment, criminal history, and future release from physical custody of the defendant, the right to be reasonably protected, and the general right to be accorded with due dignity and respect. One problem that we've seen, however, is that a person generally becomes entitled to these rights only after the prosecuting attorney or the court determines that they are a crime victim under the statute, or otherwise only after the defendant has been, quote, charged with or convicted of certain enumerated crimes. This tends to leave a huge gap in terms of the protection and standing for all crime victims, but especially and disproportionately sexual assault victims, during the investigative and pre-charging stages of a criminal proceeding, which is what Melissa's law generally applies to. This is a critical issue, I think, as many criminal cases, especially sexual assault cases, never proceed to formal charging. If crime victims have no rights during the criminal investigation, then many crime victims will never have any rights at all. One of the major implications of this concerns access to case information, which is something we've just talked about, but it extends beyond that as well. And we think about what the goals of crime victims' rights laws are. The first is to keep victims informed about the developments in the criminal justice process, but that need to be informed doesn't begin with the filing of a formal charge. A crime victim needs to know what's happening before formal charging, during a criminal investigation, for example, just as much as she needs to know what's happening in court. Indeed, there might actually be a greater need to know what's happening during the investigation, as she may be concerned that the criminal who harmed her is still on the loose, posing a danger to her. Similarly, the second purpose behind victims' rights laws, which is facilitating victim participation, this also concerns that, because without a right to pre-charging involvement, victims may effectively be shut out of the process entirely. So to provide another example, victims are generally provided with the right to be informed at any critical stage of the proceeding. But what I've seen happen quite a bit is if there is a decision not to charge, victims aren't notified of that decision. So they're left just kind of hanging out for months until they work up the courage to call enough people, if they do that, and figure out that, oh no, we're not, no one's moving forward. The investigation's over and done, and the DA made a decision, and that's it. Sometimes they find themselves, again, waiting months without hearing anything. They interpret the silence to mean that the police or prosecutors have chosen not to pursue criminal charges because they don't believe them, or because they don't have a case, criminal or civil, against their perpetrator. They would wonder whether they did something wrong to cause law enforcement officials not to believe them or pursue their case. And in sum, the reason why this is important is allowing victims to participate early in the process avoids re-traumatizing them. And there are, of course, procedural and administrative challenges to providing victims with updates about the status of their case throughout the process, not to mention the status just of the rape kits alone, as we've seen. But on that note, I would note that several states have passed laws which provide for funding or development of statewide tracking systems. Just last week, actually, Michigan's governor approved a budget bill which allocated, I think, $4 million to development of an electronic rape kit tracking system. In April of 2016, I know Washington passed a law requiring development and operation of a statewide tracking system. Utah passed a similar measure in June, which provided for the immediate implementation of a statewide hotline, as well as development of additional tools for tracking technology through a federal grant. There are also a bunch of software tracking programs that are available out there. I know Multnomah County has developed kind of their own, but there is one in particular that I would just bring to your attention, which is called Stax DNA's Track It software. And that software is designed especially and particularly for DNA crime labs, and it allows law enforcement and lab technicians and sexual assault survivors all to keep up with where a rape kit is throughout the entire process. It's similar to UPS tracking. They essentially slap a barcode on the rape kit and then they scan it at different stages of the process, and it's all uploaded online to a database. The same thing was happened after it's taken to the DNA lab to be processed and then back to the police once tested. And they've developed this system because some states have specific mandates on how quickly a sexual assault kit has to be tested, just as we do here. The system is also programmed to provide notifications to remind law enforcement and other actors whether or not and when an action needs to be taken on a kit. And another key aspect of the notification is the notification for survivors itself. And although every state has different laws about survivors' rights to know about the rape kits, Stax DNA software has the option of allowing survivors themselves to pick whether or not they want to opt in for notifications when the kit moves from one location to another or when the results have come back. There's no information directly identifying any of the survivors in the system. It's essentially a tracking number that the victim can use to log in from any device and check when it's most convenient for them. Sexual assault and rape are crimes that strip a victim of their autonomy and choice. And so for this reason, I think it's important that we ensure that we're providing empowerment rather than additional re-traumatization. And one of the most important ways that I think we can do this is by providing victims with knowledge and information. That allows them to make informed choices about their level of participation and comfort in the process. Even conveying that there is no new update is still information that's valuable to a survivor. At the very least, it tells them they're not forgotten. This, in turn, also results in greater cooperation and active involvement for the survivor, both within, I think, the criminal and civil context. And that leads me kind of to the final point that I want to make, which concerns the handling of anonymous kits. So, as we all know, Melissa's Law prohibits the testing of anonymous safe kits. This is, in general, a good thing. We want to make sure that victims are empowered to decide when and if they just want to move forward at their own speed and at their own discretion. But I think we are missing an opportunity here to provide victims with an even greater degree of autonomy. And that is specifically, well, for in all my years of working as a sexual assault victim advocate, and now as an attorney, and for all of the hundreds, if not thousands, of sexual assault survivors I've met, I have never once met a sexual assault survivor whose primary motivation in coming forward was for herself or himself, or to get retribution or vengeance or some other type of personal gain. It's always been to prevent someone else from being harmed like they were, to prevent the perpetrator from doing it again. In that oppressive darkness, and in that crushing pain and the shame and the self-blame, guilt and that fear and humiliation, that suffering that results from sexual assault and rape, that's the one ray of light that breaks through, that gives them the courage to come forward, not for themselves, but for others. And I can't tell you how many times I've spoken with victims who weren't sure whether or not they wanted to deal with the criminal process for their own sake, but who wanted to know if they could get an anonymous kit and yet still consent to having it tested. In essence, they're looking for a type of conditional anonymity, wherein if the results of testing showed that there was another victim, either concurrently existing or arising sometime in the future, they could still help by turning possibly a he said, she said case into a he said, she said case. Then at least there's some meaning to the pain to help someone else. So one suggestion is that there be a prohibition on testing anonymous kits absent written consent of the victim. That option would allow a sexual assault survivor who's unsure whether or not they want to report to the police or participate in a full criminal prosecution to nonetheless provide consent for the evidence to be tested and DNA profile uploaded into CODIS. So although a non-reporting victim might later decide to report to police and thereby trigger the mandatory testing of the kit, allowing them to consent to the testing of the kit, regardless of whether they ultimately choose to make an official report, would likely increase, at the very least, anonymous reporting, as it would empower them and simultaneously reassure them that their decision to obtain a rape kit, regardless of whether they participate in the prosecution, may help another victim in the future through, for example, collateral evidence of the perpetrator's attack. So in summary, throughout this presentation, I've attempted to shed light on some issues pertaining to victim access to evidence and other than safe kits, as well as additional rights of victims. To recap, we discussed the scope and application of Melissa's Law, the limitations on victims' ability to access and obtain safe kits without cost in some instances, the importance of recognizing and protecting documentary and physical evidence beyond simply that which is contained in the safe kit, the challenges victims face in accessing case information beyond the results of testing of the safe kit, the need to recognize victims' rights in the investigative and pre-charging stages of the criminal process, opportunities for alternative mechanisms to keep victims apprised of the status of evidence in their case, and the possibility of allowing victims to want to do an anonymous report to otherwise still consent to it being tested, as well as some of the hurdles that adult sexual assault survivors face in seeking civil remedies in light of those aforementioned challenges. So I hope this presentation has been helpful. I welcome any questions you might have, and thank you again for allowing me to be here today.
Questions?
I'm still trying to absorb all this stuff.
So quickly went through. It was amazing information, and I'm just still trying to absorb it. So that was really good.
Ms. Swanson, once again, thank you for the presentation. And You've worked long and hard together with Ms. Tracy, and your fingerprints in a positive way are all over Melissa's Law. And it was a pleasure of mine to work with you to getting that as good as we could at the time. And I think what I'm hearing is a suggestion that let's revisit Melissa's Law and some other statutes. And now's the time to, hey, let's take the next step. Yesterday was the time as well, but certainly today and tomorrow are the times. Maybe starting with a question that was how you ended. We, as you know, you and I spent some time talking about revisiting the definition of anonymous kit. Mm-hmm. And as I listened to that point, of course, that's another area unintentionally didn't think about that category of sexual assault victim that meets that conditional anonymity, which makes all the sense in the world to me. As did so many, you covered a lot of ground, as did so many other aspects of what you addressed. I guess the best kind of question to cover lots of ground that you did, and that is, do you have an idea of a vehicle? And what I mean by that is it something where we revisit SB 1571, reopen Melissa's Law, and make some adjustments in there, and some other statutes, or a standalone piece of legislation that attempts to address so many of these things? Because I think I didn't count all of them, but I'll bet your ideas, which are, many of them are tremendous ideas, cover a lot of different statutes. What's your thought? Have you thought about that next step?
I've thought about that. I think that quite a few of these issues can probably be addressed by potentially revisiting Melissa's Law. But there are certainly some things that need to have an independent vehicle. The statute of limitations issue, for example, that's something that is not only deserves an independent vehicle. I mean, if that was something that folks wanted to visit, that's something that deserves an independent vehicle, not just because of the fact that we're looking at something different than just SafeKit evidence and testing, but there will be folks on all sides who have lots of opinions about it. We want to make sure that stakeholders are able to get their input in. I think with the SAVE Fund, I think that some of those issues in terms of the SAVE Fund and victims getting billed from the hospitals and stuff, I wonder if it might be appropriate to have a conversation about that further within the context of, for example, victims' access to making sure they're able to actually obtain a safe kit and have a sexual assault nurse examiner within their county. That's kind of something I wonder might be more appropriate there. But I do think that a lot of these things can be addressed by amending portions of Melissa's Law. But at the end of the day, there are going to be statutes that need to be amended. Currently, there are some things that I came across just when I was pulling the statutes for this so that I made sure I had the appropriate language. You know, it says, I think in the Safe Fund statute, it says something like, law enforcement is only required to keep rape kits for 6 months. It still says that. And it's like, well, it's not quite the law anymore. But so I think there will need to be other types of amendments, but I appreciate the question. It wasn't necessarily something I had quite thought about in that context before, but it's valuable.
Well, let's think about it, and I know you looked at me and I uttered the word yes when you're referring to the homicide involving Melissa Bittler, and as you know, that was a case that I worked on. And we did, and we were fortunate. I presumed that we were going to find the evidence that was retained, but we were fortunate that it was. When we had a 2001 homicide, Melissa's homicide, and then through the process that you summarized, worked backwards back into 1996 and before 1996 relative to viable cases from a statute of limitations standpoint. And while we were extremely disappointed that we had safe kits that were untested, they were still present, and we did test them, together with other evidence that had been collected and remained, had not been destroyed. The summary of all of that was it did allow us to connect several investigative dots relative to crime victims of the past that had not had their cases addressed appropriately. We were able to do what we could to fix that as best we could, just because I can't help but say it, Michelle Horst and Janet Chaw came down and were present for the signature of Governor Brown on Melissa's Law, as were Tom and Mary Bittler. The point of, I guess, those, and maybe I'll stop because I could talk all day about both the great aspects of what occurred following a tragedy, but several tragedies within Melissa's death. being the biggest tragedy. The point of that, though, is had those pieces of forensic evidence been destroyed, albeit 5 years, some of those positive aspects of what we were able to accomplish, positive being, you know, a loose term sometimes, but had they not been in place, we would maybe not have been able to attain some of those sites of that case. So you will find an ally in, as you, I think you know, in me in my office about trying to, I'm not sure we'll be able to take them all on at once, all right? As you know, the statute of limitations, my office worked long and hard to assist in getting it where it is. Mm-hmm. Certain negotiations that occur, right? And we are where we are, but that doesn't mean we don't take another run at things together with other aspects. So keep us in mind. Let's talk. I'm interested. Of course, we always want partners, not just me in my office. That's where the rest of you all come in, is who else wants to kind of participate in this and begin to, what do we do, and prioritize in some ways, right? Because it is a long list of very important things to address. Thank you for your hard work.
Other questions? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. So as you know, life can be kind of messy, and we don't go through this world with a divide between criminals and victims. I work for the Public Defender's Office, and your clients become my clients. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of wondering what your feeling would be on allowing, once tragically one of your clients become one of my clients, allowing, in your idea, allowing specifically access to that kind of evidence for purposes of mitigation in a prior criminal prosecution of somebody who has been a victim in the past. And the legislature has, in this past session, specifically allowed courts to consider someone's status as a victim of domestic violence as a mitigating consideration for sentencing. What are your thoughts about the same sort of consideration for somebody who's been a victim of sexual assault?
I would love to hear more about that. I think it depends on a couple of things, because I am not up to date on what the most recent discussions were about this, but off the top of my head, it certainly sounds like that should be something that would be a mitigating factor at sentencing, at the very least. I don't know if it is appropriate if it was an affirmative defense. I just don't know exactly how it would be put forward, but yes, I think that that's, depending on the crime also, it's such a lawyer answer, it depends, but my gut says yes, I would be very interested in learning more about that and participating in those discussions if you think that I would have something valuable to contribute.
Anyone else? Yes, Bibi.
When it comes to the Safe Fund, I know that you obviously, like, I'm keenly aware of the limitations of the Safe Fund, including some that aren't even listed here. But I'm wondering what outreach you've done as far as, like, you know, connecting with other service providers, even folks of the state, the Safe Fund, you know, and to get their insight. And also, what are other states doing?
The question about other states is something that I haven't really had a chance to look too much into. I've looked quite a bit into, you know, vowel regulations and federal requirements, but in terms of the state-by-state different funds, mm-hmm. and how they've been approaching it within their own systems, I would have to look into that more. As to the question of reaching out to other service providers, I have not done that because this policy type work I do because I care deeply about it and I love it, and I don't get paid for any of it, which is fine and great, but I also have a law firm, so I don't usually get a whole lot of time to contact other interested partners. So that's something that I would love to do more of. But I agree with the fact that, yes, we definitely need to be reaching out to other partners and hearing other opinions. This was just from my personal experience and what I've seen, which is why, you know, I kind of look to you as in terms of saying whether or not this is an exception, or if it is, as my intuition tells me, something that happens far more common.
Far, far common.
Yeah. That's. I am sad to hear that, but not surprised. So to answer your question, no, I haven't done outreach to other service providers, and I'd be happy to look into the issue of, you know, how they're handling safe funds in other states. I mean, aside from the federal requirements, mm-hmm. if that's something that would be helpful.
Yeah, definitely, I would. appreciate that.
So on the software tracking front, my expectation, is that the Legislative Assembly will see a bill this session on that topic, so stay tuned.
Okay.
I think you mentioned the Multnomah County built something from the ground up. I was under the impression it was the City of Portland.
It was. It was the City of Portland's Police Bureau that built it with grant funding relative to the same project. There's just different aspects to it.
So I'm hoping to get someone in to the next task force meeting to talk about that. So just FYI.
Right. That's great. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your passion and the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Okay. Thank you. And stick around.
Okay.
We'll just have more fun. So, Captain, thank you for being able to get here for us. Appreciate it.
I'm so sorry. I apologize for being stuck. I did my best. It wasn't up to the measure, so but
no
I'm
need,
glad to be here.
No need for apologies.
You don't have lights on top of your car.
So we're hoping you're going to talk to us a little bit again on, from your perspective, the update on the Safe Kids.
Certainly. Happy to do that. I'd like to jump into the software thing because that was just discussed. The Stax Track-It software was the model that we used for pricing the federal grant that we were successful on a little bit over a year ago. So we're now in the process, as most of you know, when a government agency wants to apply for a grant, the first step is to get the permission from the legislature to make the application. If we're successful, then you get to make the application. If you're successful in getting the federal grant, then you get to apply to the Department of Administrative Services to spend the money. And that requires more than just submission of the grant proposal. It requires a whole new business plan. And so we are in the process of drafting and redrafting a business plan that will meet DAS expectations and requirements. I think that will go to DAS. I'm hopeful that will go to DAS on Monday. So the money, I think, was spendable a little bit over a year ago. If we're lucky, we'll be able to purchase, at least start the DAS procurement process maybe in February, hopefully sooner. So, and on the SafeKit front, there's only good news, and we have almost everybody through almost all of the training. I think the status is we have two people that are just basically waiting for the last part of the training module. And our DNA lead, Stephanie Winters-Sermano, who is a very capable woman, has decided to take those two people and put them on a processing assignment that their current level of training allows. And so that we'll have more people in production immediately, and then when we get a little bit more caught up, we can return them to the last training module they have to complete. So we are taking bites out of the backlog now. Our current processing capacity exceeds at least the violent crime stuff that's coming in the door. And I'm looking forward to seeing what January and February numbers look like. The holiday season is always disruptive because there are people out on vacation and that sort of thing. But January and February, I think we'll have everybody online and producing. So we'll have a sense of how quickly we can retire the backlog then.
Any other comments or questions?
Well, I'll just
Senator Thatcher.
Maybe just offline, I'd be curious to know, maybe nothing can be done about that lapse in time where you were approved, and then a year later you're talking about maybe starting to spend it. It just seems like, wow. But maybe there's not a lot that can be done about some of that. But if there are places and junctures that you could see could be loosened up, made easier, I would love to hear about it.
I would love to talk offline about our bureaucratic requirements.
Yeah.
Well, again, thanks, folks, for being here. Thanks for being active and passionate participants. As you know, next week is Thanksgiving, and it's always a good time to be reflective of things we can be thankful for and the opportunities we have to make other people's lives a little better. And I certainly see that in each and every one of you that have participated in the rape kit testing stuff and what we need to make happen and to continue to fight the good fight to do it even better. So with that, I will adjourn. What else do I need to do, Josh?
No, do you mind if I just remind folks about our next meeting? We're looking at January 9th. And the hope is that we'll have a presentation from the Board of Nursing on telemedicine. on from the hospital representatives on access to care, from the Oregon Innocence Project on testing issues and training issues, and the City of Portland on the software project. The other thing I wanted to mention, that the chair and I have been discussing sort of the work of the task force is going to be interrupted by session. Post-session, I know everyone wants to talk about training, so we'd invite you to send us thoughts in advance of that about training, and so we can get that post-session task force meeting going. But for now, please mark January 9th on your calendar.
And with that, I will adjourn this meeting. Thank you so much. And with that, I will adjourn this meeting. Thank you so much.